humans can basically very quickly learn new things. They know exactly when they see something new. They can learn from very few training examples. And they can learn with very little computational effort.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas current techniques, they can only learn a small number of things with lots of data and lots of computational effort.
Right.
That's a big gap, which causes all sorts of issues when you apply these techniques to the real world.
Welcome to episode 2 of SegFault from Honesty is Best. SegFault is a podcast about computer science research. This episode is about computer vision, and it features Professor Bharat Hariharan of Cornell University. I'm your host, Soham Sankaran. I'm the CEO of Pashi, a startup building software for manufacturing, and I'm on leave from the PhD program in computer science at Cornell University, located in perpetually sunny Ithaca, New York. Computer science is composed of many different areas of research, such as operating systems, programming languages, algorithms, and cryptography. Each of these areas has its own problems of interest, publications of record, idioms of communication, and styles of thought. Not to mention, one level deeper, a multitude of sub-areas just as varied as the areas they're contained within. This can get extremely confusing very quickly, and I certainly didn't know how to navigate this terrain at all until I was in graduate school. SegFault, in aggregate, is intended to be a map of the field, with each episode featuring discussion about the core motivations, ideas, and methods of one particular area, with a mix of academics ranging from first-year graduate students to long-tenured professors. I hope that listeners who have dipped their toes in computer science or programming, but haven't necessarily been exposed to research, get a sense of not only the foundations of each area, what work is being done in it now, and what sorts of opportunities for new research exist for people just entering, but also what it is about each specific area that compelled my guests to work in it in the first place, and what the experience of doing research in that area every day actually feels like. This is the map of CS that I didn't even know I desperately wanted in high school and undergrad. And I hope folks who are just starting their journey in computer science will find within it ideas that excite them so much and so viscerally that they can't help but work on them. Just a quick note, the first episode of SegFault was about programming languages, about the research area of programming languages. If you haven't already listened to it, you can find it at honestyisbest.com/segfault. My company, Pashi, is actually hiring somebody with experience in programming languages and in compilers, ideally in both industry and in academia. If you fit this description or know somebody that would be a good fit, please reach out. Send me an email at soham@pashi.com. That's soham@pashi.com. So I'm with Professor Bharat Hariharan, who does computer vision. If you want to introduce yourself briefly.
I'm Bharat. I do computer vision and machine learning. My interests are in visual recognition. I came here after a couple of years at FAIR, Facebook AI Research, and before that I was a PhD student at UC Berkeley.
Where you worked with Jitendra Malik, who was one of the sort of major pioneers of vision recently. What was it that got you into computer vision in the first place? What was your journey to like choosing this as your research field?
A variety of things. So I think the first source of my interest was that I was actually originally interested in psychology and how brains work. I think that's been sort of a long-standing interest of mine. And when I started working on computer science, or when I started studying computer science, that was the thing that I kept going back to, like, why can't computers do what humans can? The other part of it was just images and visual media. I had a brief infatuation with computer graphics, and which also led to this question of why can't machines understand images as well as humans do. So that's sort of roughly the route I took, which is sort of a fairly short route, but it serves as the motivation.
Okay, what was the first problem that was very interesting to you in vision, like, or the first problem that you worked on?
So the first problem I worked on was very different from the first problem that caught my interest.
Let's talk about both.
The first problem I worked on was actually this problem of 3D reconstruction. So I was in IIT Delhi at the time, and one of my mentors, Professor Subhashish Banerjee, we called him Suban, he had this project where they were trying to digitize a lot of the historic monuments in Delhi and surrounding areas. So if you're not aware, Delhi, Indian Institute of Technology, Delhi is fairly close to a cluster of historical monuments that are mostly forgotten in the House Khas area. Mm-hmm. And a lot of those monuments, I mean, if you go there, you can see them, but, you know, a lot of people don't travel. So the idea was that we could create 3D models of these monuments, and then that would be educational. So the technology, I was an undergraduate. I was mostly implementing techniques that others had suggested, including people in Oxford and my MSR Cambridge. That was sort of my first exposure to computer vision. One of the big things that actually caused me to consider this as a direction for graduate study was that through some talk, I forget who gave the talk, through some talk, I got to know of work that actually Noah Snavely did when he was a graduate student. It's actually one of the papers that recently got the Test of Time Awards in Computer Vision. This was the paper which was called Building Rome in a Day. And this was a similar idea, but what they were doing was they took just internet photographs of tourist destinations like Rome and basically created this pipeline that would just take these collection of internet photographs and produce a detailed 3D model. I was fascinated by that. I was also fascinated by sort of the technical details in that. In particular, you know, when you get two images of the same scene just taken at different points of time from different locations, how do you know they refer to the same thing? And that sort of, that was actually the key piece that I ended up focusing on, so which led me to recognition. Like, how do we know we've seen the same thing before?
I see. So let's talk about this paper a bit more. So these were just arbitrary images that they'd taken off the internet or something like this. There's no pre-planning about which images to take where or anything like this.
Yeah.
How many images did they need to reconstruct?
I think this was it varied. I think lots of the images, they were going for the large scale. So they were the fact that people... So it's useful to imagine what the environment was like at that time, which is very different from what it is now.
What year was this?
This was 2000. I think the paper came out in the late 2000s. But at that time, it was not taken as a given that, you know, the internet is a resource for data. People in computer vision were still looking at sort of small scale problems, like laboratory scale problems. Or, you know, you take 5 pictures of the stepler and reconstruct this.
I see.
So the idea behind this paper, along with a few others, in particular from Microsoft Research and University of Washington, they were one of the first to recognize that, look, there is this massive resource called the internet, which now has people posting photographs of their tourism, and you can just use this to build these 3D models. And later on, the same idea got morphed into, okay, let's do recognition, blah, 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 and so on, till where we are now, where it's kind of assumed that we have all this data and we're going the reverse, where we're like, okay, you know, what if, you know...
Didn't have this data.
Yeah.
What do you think it was that motivated? Was this around the same time that the switch was happening from sort of classical vision techniques to ML techniques, or that had already happened?
This was actually not so much. So people were using machine learning. People have been using machine learning in computer vision even since the late 90s. This was actually, I would consider... So computer vision has... gone through phase. So computer vision tends to have this mood swings, maybe.
Mood swings.
Is what I'd call them. So there are certain problems that people get really excited about, and, you know, people work on them for about a decade, and then, you know, other problems take their place. Mm-hmm. So this paper was in the heyday of the time when people were talking about geometry. Right? So geometry was the 3D reconstruction was the core problem people were interested in. So 3D reconstruction has not, at that time, there were a few machine learning techniques involved, but a lot of the work, for example, Noah's paper, a lot of it is a combination of good systems building, systems challenges, plus just optimization and, you know, mathematical optimization technique. So there's not much training, there's not much machine learning in that paper per se. So the resurgence of machine learning and the focus on recognition was something that only started to pick up in the late 2000s.
So what was the key technical trick in Noah's paper? What made him able to, or their work able to recognize what that it was the same object that the multiple images were looking at?
So, well, there's the Noah, if you read Noah's paper now, right, so Noah's paper is actually a systems paper, mm-hmm. right? So the key thing is to just put together components which people had explored before, but put together in a way that was extremely robust, extremely scalable, and so on. Mm-hmm. The thing that I, as an undergraduate, got really excited by was another paper which was used in this, which was SIFT. So SIFT is Scale Invariant Feature Transform. SIFT is a paper which, you know, if you read now, even now, it's extremely, I really like the paper. It has a few key ideas, very, very well evaluated, very well motivated. And it was, I think, 2001 or 2002 was when it came out. And we're still writing papers trying to beat SIFT. SIFT is still a baseline for us. So that was the thing that really, I read SIFT as an undergraduate and I was like, wow, this is, you know, I want to do this, right? This is what I want to do. That was what kind of started the whole thing.
Okay, explain SIFT.
Okay. So the fundamental problem that SIFT is trying to tackle is that you have, let's say, two views of the same object. But they may be from very different angles. You know, the object might appear very differently. How do we sort of match them?
Mm-hmm.
And SIFT, there's two parts to the SIFT paper. The one component is detecting these key points, parts of the object that are distinctive enough that you can use for matching. And the second is description. So how do you describe these patches so that you can match them reliably across two scenes? There are significant challenges in both, but the key in way the SIFT paper describes this, which I think is a very useful way and which is how we describe it now in our courses, is that there are a set of invariances you want. There are certain transformations that might relate these two images that you don't want to, those transformations should not cause your system to fail. So the transformations that SIFT was looking at was scale transformations. So, you know, one view might be zoomed in, another might be zoomed out.
Mm-hmm.
And the other is rotations, in-plane rotations. So, you know, 2D rotations of the image, for example. And the third is 3D rotations, but to a limited extent. So, you know, 3D rotations are hard because you don't know the 3D structure. We just have the image.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are careful about it, then small amounts of 3D rotation you can tolerate. So what they did was they created this feature detection and description pipeline where they reasoned about, okay, you know, how exactly do we introduce these invariances? So like if I want scale invariance, what I should be doing is I should be running my system at many different scales and identifying the optimal scale. That way, no matter which scale the object appears in, I'll find it.
Right. Sort of brute forcing it in some sense.
In some sense, yeah. Right. The other kind of idea is if I want to do sort of invariance to perspective changes or 3D deformations, then what I need is something more sophisticated, which is I need discretization, quantization, binning, histogramming, those mm-hmm. ideas. So the combination of these two, like, you know, search across a variety of transformations and intelligent quantization or histogramming was something that SIFT introduced. And those ideas kept repeating in various forms and various other feature extraction techniques all the way up till neural networks.
So they came up with a sort of principled and reasonably applicable set of ways to describe these invariants that were useful for other applications
yeah.
as well.
Yeah.
I see.
And if you look at the SIFT paper, right, so I mean, even, you know, when, for example, Yann LeCun talks about the convolutional networks nowadays and so on, he harkens back to the way these people were describing it, which is that, oh, you know, to get, how do you get invariance? Well, you get, you know, translation invariance by something like convolution by doing the same operation at every location. You get invariance to small shifts by doing discretization and binning and pooling and so on. So those ideas have survived and they became sort of center point of all of computer vision to the extent that today no one even thinks about them. It's like, you know, second nature to most people that you have to do.
Can you describe exactly what you mean by quantization and binning here?
So the idea here is as follows. One of the biggest challenges that people don't realize when they think of computer vision is that if you take an image, so an image is essentially a 2D array of pixels,
mm-hmm.
right? Pixel values.
Right.
Now, if I just were to slightly shift my camera, right, all the pixels might move one pixel over. But now if I just look at, you know, the 2D array, the 2D array is completely different. Like
right.
if I look at corresponding indices, the pixel values are completely different.
Right.
And that throws everything off.
Right.
So what you do to get around this, and this keeps coming up at every level of reasoning. So what you do to get around this is that you can imagine taking your image. So the simplest way to do this is that you can think of reducing the size of the image.
Right.
So subsampling, right? If you do that, then the difference becomes much less, right? You know, if your image moved by one pixel in the original resolution, if you reduce resolution by a factor of half, by a factor of two, then you only moved by half a pixel. And so it leads to less changes.
Right.
So that's sort of the core idea. So what you would do is basically you take the image, you divide it into a grid. You'd
right.
use a grid to divide it.
A coarse grid.
A coarse grid.
Right.
And then in each cell, you would compute some aggregate value.
So like 4 pixels becomes 1 pixel.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So that's basically the idea. SIFT also had this other thing of using edges instead of image intensities.
Mm-hmm.
But that was something that people had thought of earlier too, that edges are more important than image intensities. But that's the quantization and binning, that you just divide it into a coarse grid and then aggregate in each grid.
Right.
So that gives you a fair amount of invariance.
So you can now compare two images that are somewhat similar, like off the same object, but from like a slightly different perspective. And if you have it coarse enough and if you're lucky, then they're going to look the same.
Yeah.
Or like substantially, you have some bound, they look substantially the same.
Yeah.
I see. And that was first introduced by the SIFT paper.
Yeah. That was one of the key ideas. I mean, to the two of us approximation, there are other related ideas that come at the same time, but SIFT was the first engineered system that got this right.
Got it. So this really caught your attention when you saw it the first time.
Yes.
As an undergrad.
Yes.
I see.
And then after that, it was sort of a fairly straightforward path to where I am in some sense.
That makes sense. Could you describe the toolkit of modern computer vision? So like both machine learning and non-machine learning components broadly.
So modern computer vision, right. So there's those two kinds of things. So a big part of modern computer vision is driven by learning. So that includes convolutional networks on what people call nowadays deep learning and the associated learning techniques. And the other part of it is geometry and physics. So how images are formed, the mathematics of that, the related properties of the geometry. There's a lot of things that, because of the way that images are taken in a particular way, that leads to certain properties that images have, that end up with certain geometric and physical properties that images have. So all of computer vision papers have usually nowadays have some combination of these two. You know, if you're doing just is this a cat or not, you use mostly convolutional networks, machine learning. If you are doing something like, reconstruct this 3D model of a car, you might actually use a combination. You might say, okay, you know, I'll use my understanding of geometry to say that how some feature matching thing will lead to a 3D model. But I might also use machine learning to refine the model based on, you know, some understanding of what a car looks like in general or something like that, right? So those are the two big toolkits, geometry and machine learning. There used to be a significant part of this which was based on signal processing. So a lot of classical computer vision is based on an understanding of Fourier transforms, frequency analysis, things like that. That's much less there now, although there's some evidence that those things are still useful.
But it's been largely replaced by the ML component.
Yeah.
I see. So let's talk about ML in computer vision. So can we talk about the perceptron model? Tell me about what that is and see if you can explain it to sort of a relatively lay audience.
So the perceptron is actually, you know, it was one of the first machine learning models, right? So the perceptron is basically, it's a very simple, it's an algorithm. It's not framed typically as, well, it's a simple algorithm. The idea is you have some number of scalar inputs and you have to predict a scalar output, which is either 0 or 1,
mm-hmm.
right? And basically, the way you're going to do this is you're going to come up with, you're going to add and subtract and multiply with some scalar weights your inputs and combine them in that way to get some number. So you might say, oh, you know, I'll take half of input A, 2 times input B, 1/3 of input C, add them all up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll compare it to some threshold value. If it rises beyond above that threshold, it is, I'm going to claim the output, the output is 1. And if it falls below the threshold, I'm going to claim the output is 0. So the threshold and these weights I'm using to mix and match different inputs, those are the things one needs to figure out for any given problem.
Mm-hmm.
And we call those typically parameters of the model. So the perceptron is the model. The parameters are the things we need to figure out. Right? So even before we figure out the parameters, we have made a certain assumption about what this decision rule looks like.
Right.
So there are only certain things I can capture with this decision rule. But assuming that we can capture this decision rule, the next thing is, how do I figure out these parameters? Now, the perceptron algorithm, the training algorithm, is basically a fairly straightforward algorithm. It basically involves going through some set of training examples where you have inputs and the corresponding output.
Mm-hmm.
And essentially, you try your current setting of the parameters. You see if you get the classification right.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't get it right, then you change your weights in a particular manner so that you get it right. And you keep doing this. And there is a proof that you can show, which says that if there was a perceptron model or setting of the parameters that would solve the task, you'll discover this.
I see. With some bounded time or as time goes to infinity?
With some bounded time. But so that's the original perceptron algorithm. After that, there's some history around this where people showed that the perceptron model is not actually capable of capturing a wide variety of techniques, and it was not a wide variety of problems, and it was not obvious how to extend that. And one of the big things that had to change to actually go from the perceptron to more recent techniques is that we had to go from a sort of algorithmic standpoint, that this is the algorithm I'll use to train, to an optimization standpoint, that this is a loss function we are going to optimize, and this is how the gradient, the optimization procedure is going to operate. So that leads to that kind of an optimization-based view, leads to a whole class of techniques ranging from logistic regression, which is the next sort of 101 machine learning model, mm-hmm. from the perceptron, to support vector machines and kernel techniques, to neural networks and beyond.
I see. This shift to sort of more optimization techniques happened when?
I'm not actually sure. So by the 90s, there were machine learning, optimization-based machine learning techniques. So there was SVM was already there, logistic regression was already there, the neural networks were already there. I don't actually know exactly when this happened. So perceptron was like invented in very fairly early on. So there was in the middle, there was this AI winter, which was when all talk of AI died down, funding dried up, everything, and so on and so forth. And when we resurfaced in the 90s, people were talking about that. So some of this also involved. So in the 80s and 90s was also backpropagation was invented, and, you know, gradient descent was being figured out by people in optimization and control. There was a lot of work going on in control theory and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of things that happened in that interim.
Gotcha. So one of the more common machine learning techniques, sort of neural net-based techniques that people use, are these convolutional neural nets. So can you talk about what a convolution is and what it means to be using a convolutional neural net in vision?
So a convolution is basically So the first step, before we talk about a convolution, we have to first talk about what a linear function is.
Right.
So we the kind of thing we talked about where we said, oh, you know, we'll just combine, we'll just multiply some inputs with some weights and add them together.
Right.
That's an example of a linear function. A convolution is a special kind of a linear function. And what a convolution does is instead of thinking of your inputs as just like a long set of inputs, your input has some structure. Usually it's a two-dimensional array or a one-dimensional array of inputs.
So this fits well with an image because you have like a two-dimensional array of inputs.
Yeah. So there's a notion of space or time. And so convolution comes first actually in the signal processing community. So that's where the whole idea comes from. And the idea is that if you want a linear function of these kinds of inputs that are invariant to space or time. So in a 2D array, you have these two spatial dimensions.
Right.
If you want a linear operation such that, you know, at every location in this 2D array, it's basically doing the same thing, that's basically a convolution. So the operation itself looks like, you know, at every location in this 2D array, you take the neighborhood of that location and pipe that to a linear function. So neighborhood, pipe that to a linear function, outcomes and output. Then you move one pixel over, again, take the neighborhood of that pixel, pipe that to a linear function, outcomes and output. You keep doing this for every location in your 2D array, and now you have a 2D array of outputs.
Right.
So that's the convolution operation.
So it's sort of like you have a slate and you're moving it from pixel to pixel.
Yeah. The other way people often think of convolution is as a sliding window. So you can think of this as being, so you have your 2D image, you have a small window through which you're looking at, and you're sliding that window over this image. And at every location where you slide the window over, and then you compute like a simple linear operation of whatever you see.
Right.
So the convolution, convolutional neural networks are basically neural networks which have the primitive operation they're built up of is convolution. So they just have convolutions, a bunch of convolutions stacked on top of each other. And the reason this is useful is because images, one property of natural images is that they are tend to be translation invariant. So there is no particular, the spatial location 1,1 is not particularly different from the spatial location 10,10. Like everything, all regions of the image are statistically the same thing, essentially. And the reason that happens is, you know, I can take a picture standing up, I can take a picture standing upside down, I can take a picture sort of kneeling on the ground, I can take a picture sort of kneeling up. So images tend to be, it's not the case that you want something different, it's rarely the case that you want the top of the image to be processed differently than the bottom of the image. You want everything to be processed similarly.
Right.
So that's sort of the reason why, and the advantage of convolution is that compared to other things is that convolution can be expressed with very few parameters. So because you're using the sliding window, you only need enough parameters to capture a function of the sliding window. So this is a fairly small window.
So it's a function of the size of the window as opposed to the size of the entire input.
Yes. So instead of like a 300 by 300 image, you're only looking at a 3x3 patch at any given time. So you need only 9 numbers to describe this operation.
So what's the sort of use case that CNNs are actually used for? Like, what do they actually do?
So right now, they do almost everything. The first, I think the simplest thing they do is recognition, which is, you know, you give an image as input and out pops a label that says, you know, dog, cat, whatever. And the way you do this is you have the model basically passes the image through a sequence of convolutions. In the middle, it does a bunch of this subsamplings and discretizations, as we talked about earlier. This is the same kind of operation that SIFT does. These networks just do it lots and lots of times to reduce like a 300 by 300 image to like a 1x1 kind of probability distribution of over class labels. So recognition is the big thing. So in goes the image, out comes the class label. But more generally, you can have things where you feed in an image and out comes some featureization of the image, some description of what's going on in the image.
Mm-hmm.
And this you can use for basically anything. So any kind of operation you want to do on images, you want to figure out whether two images are close or not, you want to figure out if image one has some artifact or not, if you want to figure, you want to match two images, anything, you can use this kind of a feature representation. And it turns out that you can train these neural networks to do one thing, like recognize cats, dogs, and other species. And in the process, they produce a good intermediate representation that just ends up being useful for lots of things.
I see. And this is sort of why people like train on ImageNet, which is this broad collection of images.
And then test on anything they want to.
Right. So what is going on here? So if I'm thinking about a recognition task, right? And I feed in a bunch of images and these convolutions are happening. What are these convolutions actually doing that allow the recognition to happen?
So it's a good question and we don't really know, right? The reason is that it's really hard to visualize what's going on. There are efforts to do this, but none of it is particularly interpretable in any way. And things that are interpretable tend not to be faithful to the operation of the network. Right? There are some things it's easy to know. So you can ask, well, what's the first layer doing? What's the first convolution doing? Right. So it turns out that the first convolution, the first thing these networks do is detect edges of various kinds. This is also, for example, what SIFT does. This is also what we know the human visual system does. Mm-hmm. So all of this, you know, it goes well with what we expect recognition systems to do, because edges are important because edges tend to be correspond to places where object boundaries exist, and object boundaries are important for capturing shape. So edges is the first thing it does.
So within each window, it's finding edges.
Yeah. And so if you look at the output of this, you'd have one convolution operation identifying all sort of vertical lines in the image. Mm-hmm. Another convolution identifying all horizontal lines in the image. As you go deeper...
And these are not engineered. This sort of happens as part of the training process.
Yes. During training, the model discovers... that it has to do this. To recognize that this is a cat, it needs to first detect edges.
So each parameter, which is some factor that's applied to the input in each of these like cells of the sliding window, it starts untrained with some like null value or something like that. Or does it start with?
It starts with random noise.
With random noise. And it becomes trained such that the first layer is detecting vertical edges.
Yes.
And then the second layer is detecting horizontal edges.
No, within the same layer, you have actually multiple filters detecting lots of things in parallel. So you have a bunch of things detecting edges of various orientations.
I see.
This next layer, what ends up happening, there is some evidence that what it ends up doing is things like corners and blobs. You know, things like, oh, there's a red corner. Oh, there's a blackish blob in the left top left corner.
And we know this because we can output the pixel output that comes out of that layer.
So you can, for the first layer, you can basically just visualize exactly what the network is doing.
Right.
For the second layer onwards, because of the fact that the operation is now non-linear, mm-hmm. so there is, in the middle, you do a bit, some sort of a non-linear operation on each pixel, which makes it hard to actually visualize.
Between the layers. What kind of operations are?
So usually, we do this thing called a rectified linear unit, mm-hmm. Which if you know signal processing, is often called half-wave rectification. So half-wave rectification means that if the output is positive, you keep it. If the output is negative, you zero it out.
I see.
So because of this operation, now it's non-linear, so it's hard to visualize what the second layer is doing. Mm-hmm. But second layer onwards, what you can do is you can ask, well, how should my image change so that this particular pixel in this second layer output gets a really high value? Mm-hmm. And if you do that, you find that what patches actually maximize a particular pixel value. You see like blobs and corners and things.
I see.
Beyond that, as you go deeper and deeper, it becomes really hard to understand what's going on. It becomes, sometimes you see some patterns like, okay, it seems to like faces. Or it seems to like, a particular colors in particular regions. But usually it becomes hard to understand. So it's hard to figure out what the network is doing. The only thing you know is that it's basically learned to do this only to fit some labels in some training set.
I see. Okay, so let's talk about a recent problem that you've worked on, that you published a paper on, and that you've effectively solved. You've come up with some kind of solution to whatever you're working on, from the beginning to what you actually built. So what was the problem and what was the solution? What did you actually do to get there?
Okay, that's a good question. Let's see. So given the context of where we are in this conversation, I'll probably pick something that's a bit older,
Sure. Which
is from my grad school times. So the problem we were looking at, so this was a problem we introduced, we started thinking about. So the goal was basically this. So I said that, you know, convolutional networks have been doing image in, label out. You can do a bit better and you can say, give me an image in and tell me not just an image level label, but tell me where the different objects are. So, you know, this is this box, this contains a horse, this box, this contains a person, and so on. For the purposes of this, it's not important to know how you do this, but basically the idea is that you come up with a few candidate boxes and then you pipe each box through a convolutional network. That's sort of the idea. So this task is often called, this problem is often called object detection. What we wanted to do was to say, okay, you know, we've figured out that this box contains a horse, but can I actually identify the boundaries of the horse?
Wait, so you're provided with an image with the box already drawn on it, or
Yeah, so for the purposes of this, let's assume we've solved that object detection.
Okay.
So in fact, we built on top of existing object detections. So we have an image and we have a bunch of boxes saying this box has a horse, this box has a person, this box has a car.
Okay.
You can also imagine just maybe a cropped image where there is a horse, you know, bang in the middle of it and large and whatever, right? But the problem is you have a box. Now you have, you know, there's a horse in it. What we want to do is we want to identify the boundaries of the horse.
Right.
And why is this important? This is important because for some applications, you really want to actually know these boundaries. So for example, you know, for robotics, you may want to actually predict how do I grasp this particular object. So you need the boundaries. Or you may, in graphics, you want to crop object from one image and place it into another. So you want to know the boundaries of the object.
So you want the minimal sort of continuous boundaries of the object.
Yeah. So you want to basically know, oh, this is the head, this is the tail, these are the legs, and so on. The problem was, now, the way these convolutional networks operate, they collapse images, large high-resolution images, to single labels, essentially. But here, for boundaries, boundaries are not, you know, single labels, right? We have to retain the resolution of the image, right? We need fairly precise localization. So the idea that we came up with, this was in discussion with my advisor. So we first posed this problem, and we had some initial techniques, and they were producing very, you know, very imprecise boundaries. They were very blobby, you know, it would be look basically like a circle. So we were like, you know, how can we get this to be more precise? And we realized that, you know, as I said before, the convolutional network is going through these stages of processing. Really early on, it has understandings of edges and line segments, which are very precise look with respect to spatial location. You know exactly where the edge is.
Right. In the first layer.
In the first layer.
Right.
And as you go deeper into the layers, the abstraction of the concepts the model network is producing increases. So you're doing going from edges to things like object parts to things like objects. At the same time, the spatial resolution of these things decreases. So what we said was, well, if we, what we can do is, when we want both, we want to know horseness, but we also want high spatial resolution. So what we'll do is we can actually take a trained network and then tap into these earlier layers. So we can say, okay, you know, I have a particular pixel in my image. I want to say, figure out whether it lies on my horse boundary or not. I'll basically ask, go to each layer of my convolutional network and look at the output there and say, okay, you know, does this pixel lie, early on I'll ask, does this pixel lie on this edge or not? Later in the middle, I'll be asking, does this pixel lie on a horse leg or not? At the end, I'll be asking, is it a horse or not?
Right.
putting that information together, I can basically solve this problem. Like I can basically tap into essentially all the intermediate things the network has computed and combine that to do this kind of localization.
I see.
And we did that, and you know, it was really, I mean, we turned this out in an afternoon, and the first results came out in an afternoon, and it was like, it was amazing. It was like really precise localization of these boundaries that we'd not seen before. And my advisor was like, I sent the images to my advisor from a coffee shop, and he was like, this looks great. Can you, the conference deadline is in 6 hours. Can you write it? I tend to be someone who's like, my answer was no. So we went for the next deadline. But that was sort of one of the key things. That was the last thing I did when I was in grad school, basically.
I see. And what you used to then extract the actual the boundaries, that was not machine learning. It was like you just sort of went in and deterministically extracted elements from each of the layers.
Yes.
To draw it on the final image.
So we just took all. We just took everything. So basically what we did was we said, instead of just taking the last whatever the network has done at the very end, we take all the intermediate stuff and stack them on together. My advisor called this a hypercolumn representation, but the general idea is also called skip connections. And usually the skip connections went the other way, where people try to use them for like just saying whether it's a cat or not. But our idea was you can actually get the spatial localization very well with this. So this was, sort of the idea. So this was taking an existing convolutional network and then figuring out how to use what it had done, already learned in an intelligent manner.
So wait, so were you connecting, so when you say skip connection, were you connecting the earlier layer to another layer up ahead, or?
You could describe the architecture in a few ways. So what we were doing, The way we described it was that we were taking the intermediate features that the network had produced and concatenating them together, appending all of them together to produce a new feature representation.
New feature, okay.
And that was being fed to a very simple machine learning model.
I see. So you had another model.
Yeah.
Okay.
It was, we tried a few variants. But now if you put all of this together, it now looks like skip connections where earlier layers are feeding into later layers.
I see what you're
so
saying.
So it's like a different interpretation of the final
end isomorphic product. Architecture.
Yes,
but it,
yes,
yeah,
yes,
yeah.
Yes.
I see. And it turned out that if you had all this information, then a simple model could easily produce very accurate bounding boxes with some labeled examples.
Yeah.
I see. That's very neat. Yeah, that makes sense. So it's sort of, I think it neatly encapsulates that we don't fully understand how these things work, but we can exploit some things about their structure to produce the sorts of results that we want.
Yeah.
So is this how you describe most of the vision research that you do now? Sort of you architect some kind of network to solve some kind of problem, and then you use features of that to do specific things in interesting ways?
Actually, nowadays, the kind of work I do takes a very different flavor. So right now, in this case, I took a trained network and tried to use my sort of domain knowledge to extract information from that. Nowadays, I take the reversed standpoint, which is that how do I, from the start, teach the network domain knowledge?
Mm-hmm.
Like the machine learning way of looking at things is, you know, give me examples and we'll figure it out.
Right.
It's kind of like teaching a kid how to do multiplication by saying nothing other than giving, you know, number one, number two, number
right.
one times number two.
Giving them the tables.
Yeah,
the
giving like a long list of tables. And sure, they'll figure it. Well, I don't know if they'll figure it out. But, you know, if you have a million examples, maybe you can figure it out.
Right.
But if you could tell, but that's not how we teach kids, right? We teach kids that this is what multiplication means. This is the algorithm to do it.
Mm-hmm.
And then the kids practice on a few examples and they're done. So that ends up being much more efficient.
Right.
So the same question applies here. Can we go beyond like just giving them a massive data set? Because usually we don't have massive data sets except in very few cases. Can we go beyond giving neural networks massive data sets and teach them some domain knowledge?
So what's an example of this, just in short?
So one simple example that we recently did was we want to train a neural network to recognize a new class with very limited training data.
Mm-hmm.
And we simply said, okay, you know, what if in addition to just the limited number of training examples, I also provide for maybe one image. I tell the network where the object is in the image. So I say maybe that this region in the image, this is where you should look at.
So you initially give it a bunch of training examples that just say the object is somewhere in this image.
Yes.
And now you also put a bounding box around the object.
On just one image.
Okay.
Right? So it's a very simple, small additional thing. And it gives like a big improvement in performance.
And you don't put the bounding box on every image because then it'd be more expensive to produce the training
set.
Yes.
So the idea is that, you know, like an expert can give one image with one bounding box. And then it can get other examples through some other process.
So if you want to do this using for diagnostics, you can say like you have all these cancer examples, and then in one case you have the diagnostician actually like paint out exactly where the tumor is.
Exactly. And that leads to significantly larger performance. I don't remember the exact number.
Does this work with just a standard CNN architecture?
There's a few caveats to this. I mean, right now we're still exploring the full extent of what all this can do. But we've got one paper out of this and one submission that seems to suggest that this is actually a fairly general idea,
mm-hmm.
but it's still, you know, I wouldn't go so far as to say that this is something that, you know, we should always do, but it seems to be the case that it's useful.
Interesting. So in this case, you just change something about the data representation for the training set without really changing anything about the architecture.
Yes.
I see.
And that's usually how I work on nowadays. So the question is, you know, it's like, my mantra for a lot of my graduate students is that, you know, if at once you don't succeed, redefine success. So the question is, can you change the problem setup to make it work better?
Wonderful.
It's the question.
Okay. So two more questions. Can you describe work, any piece of work that you've seen recently that's not your own work that you think was interesting and why you thought it was interesting?
So this is a line of work that I think is, I have initial results in, but we have initial experiments in, but I'm not an expert in this. But, and again, this is not one paper, but like a class of techniques. So this class of techniques, this has been work that's happening on essentially 3D reconstruction again,
mm-hmm.
but from a single view. So you get a single view of an object or an image and a single view of a cup, and you have to reconstruct the 3D model. And that has seen, you know, people have been using now machine learning techniques for this. And that has seen actually some incredible results where people have started. So there's work out of Berkeley, there's work out of Oxford on things, where basically what they've done is they trained the machine learning model, so that from a single image, it predicts like a hypothesis for what the 3D shape should look like. And then it tries to render the hypothesis and tries to match it with the corresponding image.
I see.
And that's how it learns. And it manages to learn, you know, fairly. It's able to, I think there are results now on just producing 3D models of, without any. So it's like, I think one of my friends a long time ago talked about this as learning single image 3D without a single 3D image, like, you don't get any 3D information during training,
mm-hmm.
but somehow you're able to, using knowledge of geometry, you're able to train the network to actually do this 3D reconstruction. So this is work from, you know, so original work from CMU, from David Fuhi and colleagues. Then there's work from Berkeley and now FAIR, from Shubham Tulsiani and colleagues. Stanford from Leo Gibas's group, and Oxford from Andrea Vidaldi's group. So these are a bunch of techniques. And NOAA I don't mention NOAA that much because, you know, you'd think I'm just, you know, biased towards Cornell. So, but NOAA also has a bunch of
things. NOAA Stavely, who you mentioned earlier. So what to your mind are the big open problems in computer vision still? Like what are the huge problems that someone might be sort of inspired to take on in the field?
So the biggest problem right now is that there's this impression especially in the public domain that computer vision is solved. Right, that we can basically do any kind of recognition task, any kind of perception task. And that's dangerous. So we're very far from any kind of solution. So it's more like, you know, what have we done is the question rather than what's left to do. The big thing that is missing is that human perception, humans can basically very quickly learn new things. They know exactly when they see something new. They can learn from very few training examples. And they can learn with very little computational effort.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas current techniques, they can only learn a small number of things with lots of data and lots of computational effort.
Right.
That's a big gap, which causes all sorts of issues when you take apply these techniques to the real world.
Mm-hmm.
One of the resulting challenges is what I think of as inequity, in the sense that right now the kinds of techniques we've produced are only really applicable to Google scale or Facebook scale problems.
So you have to be an industry or have an industry partner to be able to run these computations.
Right. And even if you are in academia and you are solving those problems, but the kinds of challenges that we are focusing on, you know, how can we learn to recognize, you know, these 200 classes from that are relevant to internet applications is very different from the kind from, you know, a million examples, right? How do I use a billion examples to build a good convolutional network?
Right.
That's very different from the kind of applications where, you know, a radiologist comes to you and tells you, I want to recognize this specific disease. And, you know, here's five images and I can give you five more if you give me a year,
right.
But I don't have a year. Right. And that's a very different, and, you know, I have this, you know, Windows 98 machine lying around to train, right? I mean, it's a very different kind of problem. And that's sort of a big blind spot right now.
I see. So sort of moving closer to the human ability to learn things with few examples and not that much computation so that we can move to kind of smaller in scope, but very, very important sort of humanitarian and other problems,
yeah.
like in diagnostics.
Yeah.
That's interesting. Do you think, sort of in a related question, do you think that it's possible to do good research in computer vision outside of industry or with no industry partnerships?
I think it is definitely possible, but I think you have to have this kind of a mindset. Like, you know, I think this is, if you talk to anyone in this area, you'll get a similar answer, which is that if you try to beat industry at the industry game, that's stupid, right? I mean, we have to play to our strengths. And our strengths in academia is exposure to a much wider set of colleagues, right? People who are doing, you know, material science, who are doing agriculture, who are doing, animal husbandry and all sorts of things.
Right.
And B, you know, the idea that we can explore ideas that don't immediately lead to impact on benchmarks.
Right. Right.
That's sort of the key thing that we have.
This longer-term focus.
Longer-term focus, right. So we, as in academicians, we need to focus on that. We need to push on that.
If you were to make a one-minute pitch to somebody who was considering doing computer science work that they should work in vision, what would that pitch be?
Well, that is a bit hard. I think the most interesting aspect of computer vision is the fact that is to me the biggest aspect of computer vision is this big, big gap between what I can do or what a toddler can do and what a machine can do.
Mm-hmm.
It's so far away from what toddlers can do. I mean, I have a one-year-old niece and, you know, so my one-year-old niece was able to, you know, when we come home, she would rush to us, take our suitcases, open the bag and throw everything out.
Mm-hmm.
Getting there in terms of, this is both robotics and vision in
right.
this case, but getting there in terms of even perception, like figuring out how did she know, having never seen that suitcase, that this was a thing you could open and this had things inside of
without
it.
Without even any actuation, just coming up with the plan at all.
Right? Like she, just one fine day she decided to do this. I mean, like what? Yeah, getting there, that's the key question, like where, how do we get there? And we're very far, we're like nowhere near. So that's I think the motivation.
Great. Thank you so much.
Yep. Cool.
Thanks for listening to that episode of SegFault. You can find Professor Hariharan at his website, bharath.info. That's bharath with another h.info. You can find me on Twitter at @SohamSankaran. That's at @SohamSankaran. And at my website, soh.am. If you like this episode, listen to some more and subscribe at honestyisbest.com/segfault. We'd appreciate very much if you shared this episode online, and in particular with anyone that you think could benefit from it. SegFault is a production of Honesty is Best. Find more of our work at honestyisbest.com. Finally, as I mentioned at the top of the episode, Pashi is hiring someone with experience in compilers and programming languages. If you fit this description or know someone who does, please feel free to email me at soham@pashi.com. That's SOHAM@PASHI.com.